Okay, well, I'm going to tell you about some experiments that we've done recently on the quantum Hall effect and three-dimensional materials. And this work is part of David Jewett's PhD thesis on the excellent material that Kevin Mironowski grew for us in Art Gosser's MBE lab. And we are grateful for the physical insight into this problem that Nancy Fisher and Leon Valens have given us. So what we're looking at is a semiconductor multilayer in the regime of the integer quantum Hall effect. And what we find is that at low temperatures, the transport current flows on a two-dimensional subsystem that lives at the sidewalls of the multilayer. And I'm going to start out by showing you what the quantum Hall effect looks like in this kind of simple three-dimensional material. And then I'll go on to tell you about what we've learned about the transport properties of this new and unusual kind of two-dimensional system. So what we're studying are aluminum gallium arsenide multilayers with small enough barriers to produce appreciable tunneling between the layers. And to study in-plane transport in this material, parallel to the layers, we just fabricate standard Hall bars. To study vertical transport, you have to find a way of forcing the current to flow perpendicular to the layers. And to do that, we look at a second MBE grown structure that has the same multilayer in it, but that is clad on the top and on the bottom by degenerately doped gallium arsenide contact layers. That allows us to run the current perpendicular to the layers and measure the vertical conductance. And this sort of multilayer study was first done about 10 years ago by a group at Bell Labs who were interested in learning whether or not the quantum Hall effect could occur in a system that's not strictly two-dimensional. And here I have reproduced some of their data for the same sort of multilayer structure that we're studying. And what they saw in in-plane transport was a quantum Hall effect that looks basically the same as it does in two dimensions. And in their relatively high temperature studies of vertical transport, what they saw was that where the in-plane transport is quantized or approaching quantization, there are dips in the vertical conductance. And this is qualitatively what you would expect weak interlayer coupling to produce. So if you just had a single sheet of 2D electron gas, the bulk density of states would have localized states everywhere except at the centers of the Landau levels where there would be single extended states. And what the interlayer coupling does is replace those single extended states with Landau bands. And so if the Fermi energy is sitting in a region of localized states, then the Hall conductance or the Hall resistance will discount the number of extended states below the Fermi energy. And that number will be the number I of occupied Landau bands times the number j of states per band, which would just be the number of layers in the multilayer. And this picture is consistent with what the Bell Labs group observed. So what we've done is revisit this problem and look at what happens to vertical transport in more detail and at lower temperatures. And for the first part of the talk, I'll be showing you data for a multilayer structure with 50 periods that has weak interlayer coupling, quite weak, that produces a nominal Kronig-Penney bandwidth of about a tenth of a millielectron volt. And when we look at in-plane transport parallel to the layers, what we see at low temperatures is a very pretty quantum Hall effect with two well-developed quantum Hall states that are nice and broad. And later on, I'll be focusing on what goes on in those quantum Hall states. And that's all I'm going to say about in-plane transport. From now on, I'll just be talking about vertical transport, which, again, we study in the same multilayer structure, but with contacts put on the top and on the bottom. So here I've just replotted the in-plane transport to remind you what it looked like. And this shows the vertical conductance plotted versus magnetic field at four different temperatures. And what you can see here is that in these regions where the in-plane transport is well quantized, there are deep dips in the vertical conductance that appear to head down to zero as the temperature drops. And that's qualitatively what you'd expect from that picture of the bulk density of states that I showed you. And before I go on to concentrate on what happens within these quantum Hall states, I'm going to take a brief detour and tell you what we have learned about transport in these transitional regions between the quantum Hall states. And in these regions, it's not expected that the bulk conductivity would vanish as the temperature goes down. And that's because in these transitional regions between quantum Hall states, the Fermi energy now you would expect, would lie inside of one of these extended state Landau bands. And in that case, the longitudinal conductivity should be non-vanishing at low temperatures, and the system should act like a three-dimensional metal. So to see if that's in fact what happens, what we've done is fix the magnetic field at these peaks in the vertical conductance, and then we've measured the temperature dependence. And what you can see in this plot of the log of the vertical conductance versus 1 over the temperature is that at high temperatures, there's a sort of gradual decay of the vertical conductance. But then once you get below about half a degree or so, the vertical conductance pretty much flattens out. And so that says that the system is acting like a metal. And then if the system is acting like a 3D metal, the vertical conductance should be proportional to the cross-sectional area of the samples. And to see whether or not that's the case, what Dave did was fabricate on one little piece of the multilayer material several maces that have different sizes and different shapes. So this is a cartoon of a top view of the sample that has these six different maces on it. Okay, and so what we do then is again fit at this magnetic field in these peaks of the vertical conductance and look at how the conductance of these different maces scales with their cross-sectional area at a fixed temperature of 50 millikelvin. And what you can see here is that the vertical conductance is proportional to the cross-sectional area. So in these transitional regions, in between the quantum Hall states, the system is acting like a 3D metal. All right, so now I'm going to turn to talking about what happens in the quantum Hall states. And this is the same data that I showed you before, except now the vertical conductance has been replotted on a logarithmic scale. And this closer look at the data shows something interesting, and that is that as the temperature goes down, the vertical conductance, in fact, doesn't appear to keep dropping towards zero. And if all you think about is this picture of the bulk density of states that I showed, that is surprising, okay, because since the in-plane transport is quantized, the Fermi energy should lie in a region of localized states, and both of the longitudinal bulk conductivity should vanish. Okay, so you think that if the transport is through the bulk, the temperature goes down, the vertical conductance should keep freezing out. So to look at this in more detail, they fixed the magnetic fields at the centers of these quantum Hall states and then measured the temperature dependence of the vertical conductance for one of the maces. And if you just focused on the high temperature part of this plot, which is down here, it would look roughly like what you'd expect. So at high temperatures, the vertical conductance is dropping off fast, consistent with the bulk freezing out. But then at low temperatures, what happens is that the vertical conductance saturates and is basically constant. Okay, and so that says that in this low temperature regime, the system is actually acting like a metal. So to try to get an understanding of this, what we've done is look again at the size dependence of the vertical conductance. And here I've just replotted the same data, which again is taken within this I is equal to 1 and I is equal to 2 quantum Hall state. And what's plotted here in this inset is the conductance of the six different maces measured at a fixed temperature of 330 millikelvin in this region where the vertical conductance is dropping off fast. And what you see is basically what you'd expect on this log-log plot of conductance versus area. The points for all six of the maces lie along a straight line of slope 1. Okay, so that says that the conductance is proportional to the cross-sectional area of the sample, or in other words, the current is flowing throughout the bulk. Now, if we try to do the same thing at low temperatures in this metallic regime, we get a very different result. So here I plotted the vertical conductance of the six different maces at 50 millikelvin versus their cross-sectional area. And what you can see is that all of the samples that are squares, which are shown on this plot as squares, follow along straight lines of slope equal to a half in both the I is equal to 1 and the I is equal to 2 quantum Hall state. And that says that for these samples, the conductance is scaling like the square root of the area. And furthermore, the samples that aren't squares lie above these lines. And so that suggests that what we should be doing is plotting the conductance versus the perimeter of the sample. And when we do that, just take the same data and replot it versus the perimeter of the sample, you can see that all the data now lies along nice lines of slope 1 on this log-log plot. So this says that in this low-temperature metallic regime, the conductance is proportional to the mesa perimeter, or in other words, the current is flowing along a two-dimensional subsystem that lives at the sidewalls of the multilayer. And this metallic two-dimensional transport on a surface sheet is what was predicted for quantum Hall states about 2 years ago in independent work by Chalker and Doman and by Valence and Fisher. And where the surface sheet is coming from, as John Chalker described, is the coupling of the edge states that run around the quantum wells of the multilayer. So if you just had a single 2D electron gas in the quantum Hall effect, the states in the bulk of the Fermi energy would be localized, but the lateral boundaries introduce these extended edge states that run around the perimeter. So when the interlayer coupling is turned on, the edge states merge to form a two-dimensional surface sheath that is extended around the perimeter and also apparently is extended vertically. So to summarize what goes on in vertical transport, I show here a cartoon of the vertical conductance versus the magnetic field. And as the magnetic field varies, what happens is that transport alternates between 3D metallic transport in the transitional region between quantum Hall states and 2D metallic transport on the surface sheath within these quantum Hall states. And although the in-plane transport in the quantum Hall states is universal or quantized, the vertical transport is not. Okay? And that's because the sheet conductivity of the surface sheath depends on a bunch of parameters that are sample-specific and also field-dependent. And so it's not expected that the vertical conductance in these quantum Hall states, which is just proportional to the sheet conductivity of the surface sheath, it's not expected that you get flat regions here. And in fact, that's what we see. On the bottom here, I have plotted a blow-up of the vertical conductance measured in the I is equal to 1 and I is equal to 2 quantum Hall states. And just for reference, on the top, I show what the longitudinal in-plane resistance is doing. And what you can see is that the magnetic field sweeps across these quantum Hall states, the vertical conductance does vary somewhat. And it's interesting to take the vertical conductance data and use it to find the sheet conductivity of the surface sheet. So we know the vertical conductance, and we know the sample perimeter, and we know the height of the multilayer, and from those quantities, then we can find the sheet conductivity of the surface sheet. And what we see is that in both the I is equal to 1 and that I is equal to 2 quantum Hall state, that the sheet conductivity of the surface sheet is really, really small compared to the conductance quantum. And remember, this small conductivity is coexisting with temperature-independent behavior. And so what we're finding is that this surface sheath can have metallic conductivity that are much smaller than E squared over H. And that is unusual for a two-dimensional system. If you just had an ordinary two-dimensional system and you found that the sheath conductivity was small compared to E squared over H, that would signify localization. And then what you would see is that the sheath conductivity would be falling exponentially as the temperature went down. And in contrast, we see this very tiny metallic sheet conductivity. And so that suggests that there's something special about this two-dimensional system that suppresses localization. And that special ingredient is that transport on the surface sheet is unidirectional around the circumference. So the surface sheet is forming from coupling of the edge states. And the edge states have a handedness to them that's set by whether the magnetic field is up or down. And so when the edge states of the individual quantum wells couple together, the surface sheath that they form also has a handedness to it. And so the transport is one way around the perimeter. And that is what suppresses localization. And that's because sort of a minimal requirement to form a localized state is that electrons be able to get back to their starting point or move in self-intersecting trajectories. And that happens naturally in ordinary two-dimensional systems because transport is diffusive in both directions. And so an electron trajectory would be a random walk, which would intersect itself many times. On the surface sheath, however, there's diffusive transport only in the z direction, perpendicular to the layers, and the flow in the circumferential direction, as I mentioned, is in one direction only. So that means that if you had an infinite sample of this material, you could never get localization because electrons could never come back to their starting point. And of course, real samples are not infinite. And so it's possible that in a finite size sample, an electron might be able to get back to its starting point before it diffused out of the system. And so that means that the nature of transport on the surface sheath should depend on how big around it is, the circumference C, relative to its height, H, the height of the multilayer. And recently, Grusberg, Reed, and Sakdev have worked out in the phase coherent limit how transport on the surface sheath depends on its size. And what they find is that there are three distinct regimes that are separated by two lengths that depend on the circumference of the sample. So one of these lengths is the distance L1 that an electron diffuses vertically in the time that it takes it to go around the sample once. And the other is a localization length along the z-axis. So if you have a short, fat surface sheet, then electrons will diffuse out of the system before they can go all the way around. And that means there's no possibility for localization, and the system acts like a 2D chiral metal. On the other hand, if you had a skinny, tall surface sheet, where tall is relative to the localization length, then the system acts like an insulator. And in between these insulating and 2D chiral metal phases, there is a 1D chiral metal regime where electrons can go around and around before they diffuse out of the system, but the height of the multilayer is small compared to the localization length. And what's expected is that the mean conductance in these two metallic regimes should be the same, but the amplitude of the conductance fluctuations should be quite different. So in the phase coherent limit, it would be possible to distinguish between these two regimes just from the conductance fluctuations. Okay, these length scales, L1 and the localization length, as you can see, are defined in terms of fundamental constants and parameters that we can measure. And so we can calculate what the regime diagram looks like for the multilayer structure that we've been studying. And that's shown here. Okay, and I've added to this regime diagram crosses that represent the samples that we studied. And what you can see is that, except for the largest two samples, all of them lie well inside of this 1D localized regime. Okay? And that appears to be a contradiction, because what we observe is that all of the samples, from the smallest to the largest, have the same metallic sheet conductivity. And what this seems to be telling us is that the surface sheets that we're studying are not phase coherent. Okay? In order to localize, not only does an electron have to be able to get back to its starting point, it has to do so without losing phase. And so the fact that we see metallic behavior in even the smallest sample that we've studied just suggests that the dephasing lengths on the surface sheet are a lot smaller than the circumference of the sample. And that's no great surprise, because even the smallest sample that we've studied has a circumference on the order of a millimeter. And this interpretation that we're not seeing localization because the system's not phase coherent is bolstered by the temperature dependence of the conductance fluctuations. So here I show some detailed traces of the conductance for the second to the smallest sample that we studied, which is this guy. And what you can see is that as the temperature goes down, the amplitude of these reproducible fluctuations grows without any sign of saturation. And so that suggests that even at the lowest temperature, the sheath is still not fully phase coherent. And very recently, Cho, Valence, and Fisher have worked out how inelastic scattering affects transport on the surface sheath. And since the sheath is anisotropic, there are two dephasing lengths. One, the circumferential dephasing length, LC, depends on the edge velocity and an inelastic time. And then there's also a diffusive Z-axis dephasing length that turns out to be related to LC by parameters that we know. Okay, so if we can find one of these dephasing lengths, then in principle we know the other. And what these people showed is that inelastic scattering introduces a set of incoherent phases into this regime diagram. And in particular, there's an incoherent 1D metal regime and an incoherent 2D metal regime. And what we'd like to do is use the fluctuation of the conductance in these incoherent regimes to learn about dephasing at the edge or the surface of a quantum Hall system, because that's something that's not very well understood right now. And we should be able to do that because the conductance fluctuations in these regimes should depend on what these length fields are. And Cho, Valens, and Fisher have shown that there are two different ways you can go about extracting these dephasing lengths from the conductance data. So one approach is to look at the variance of the conductance, and that's related to the dephasing lengths in different ways in these 1D and 2D incoherent regimes. And a second way to go about it is to look at the magnetic field scale over which the conductance fluctuations are correlated. And that magnetic correlation field, again, is related to the dephasing length in a different way in the 1D and 2D incoherent metallic regimes. And then if everything is right, these two different ways of estimating the dephasing length should give consistent results. So we've used this picture to analyze the conductance data for this weakly coupled multilayer. 3 minutes? Okay. And what we find is that if we just use the variance of the conductance fluctuations at 50 millikelvin, that gives us a circumferential dephasing length of about 10 microns. And on the other hand, if we use the magnetic correlation field to estimate the circumferential dephasing length, we get about 30 microns at 50 millikelvin. And this is probably not terrible given the systematic errors in figuring out what these quantities are. But what's more disturbing is that as the temperature goes up, the discrepancy between these two estimates for the circumferential dephasing length also grows, until at 150 millikelvin there's a discrepancy of about a factor of 50. So that suggests that there's something that's still missing in the analysis. Of course, we don't know for sure what that is, but one possibility is that as the temperature goes up, thermal averaging starts to have a significant effect. So the Fermi distribution has a width of about kT, which means that there are electrons with different wavelengths, and when you average together their interference patterns, that's going to wash out the conductance fluctuations. However, for this weakly coupled multilayer, there's another complication, and that is that when we find the z-axis dephasing length that corresponds to even the largest value of the circumferential dephasing length, it turns out to be smaller than the period of the multilayer. And the results that I showed you on the previous transparency for extracting dephasing lengths from conductance fluctuations are, strictly speaking, only valid if this z-axis dephasing length is a lot bigger than the period of the multilayer. And so to try to get around that problem, what we've done is look at transport on a much more strongly coupled multilayer that has a nominal Cronin-Penney bandwidth that's about 20 times larger. And what we see in in-plane transport and in vertical transport, and this structure is about qualitatively the same as what we observed in the more weakly coupled multilayer. And we fabricated from this material much smaller samples in the hopes of getting into the phase coherent regime. And these vertical transport matrices are cylinders. The smallest one has a diameter of 4 microns. And since I'm kind of running out of time, okay, I'll just tell you that the amplitude of the conductance fluctuations in even the very smallest samples we've looked at, which has a circumference of 13 microns, is still smaller than what you would expect in the phase coherent limit. So even this little bitty sample is still not a phase coherent object. And finally, so that would mean that we should be able to use the conductance fluctuations to extract dephasing lengths. Okay. And when we try to do that, even for this strongly coupled or relatively strongly coupled multilayer, we still can't get consistent results. So again, there appears to be something that is missing in the analysis of the conductance fluctuations. So in conclusion, And I've showed you that in the quantum Hall effect, in a very simple kind of three-dimensional material, the transport current flows on a two-dimensional subsystem that lives at the sidewalls of the multilayer. And the subsystem is formed by the coupling of the edge states of the quantum wells of the multilayer. And since it is a highly anisotropic object, it has unusual transport properties. And we hope that in the not-too-distant future, a more detailed understanding of the conductance fluctuations will emerge so that we can use the fluctuations to find out about dephasing at the edge of a quantum Hall system. Thank you.
What are the two-dimensional mobilities and two-dimensional densities for the samples you showed?
The per layer sheet density for the weakly coupled multilayer is about 2 times 10 to the 11th per layer, and the mobility is on the order of 20,000 centimeters squared per volt second. For the more strongly coupled multilayer, the density is about a factor of 2 higher, and the mobility is about a factor of 2 lower.
What are the experimental prospects for some fraction of one Hall effect? How much cleaner does the sample
test? Okay, well, the mobility is going to have to go up by, it's on the order of 10,000. To see a nice fractional quantum Hall effect, we need something like a couple of hundred thousand. And so in these kinds of multilayers, the prospects are rather dim. But Louise Bray actually suggested recently that you might be able to get there by looking at a multilayer that's embedded in a parabolic quantum well. And then it can be doped just on the two sides of the big bad parabolic quantum well. And maybe you could get the mobilities high enough to get into the fractional regime, which would be very interesting. Okay. Pardon? So let me show you the transparency that summarizes the results that Sorocho and Leon and Matthew Fisher got. Okay. So there are two different ways to do it. One is to look at the amplitude of the conductance fluctuations. Okay, and that, let's see, maybe I should back up. So you could view the surface sheath as being made up as a network of phase coherent units. And so you can treat the system sort of like a resistor network, and in that way relate the conductance, the variance of the conductance fluctuations to these dephasing lengths. Okay, so that's one approach for getting the dephasing lengths from the variance of the conductance fluctuations, which is what we measure. Okay, so we measure this. We know the height of the multilayer, for example, and so the only thing that's not known are these dephasing lengths. And again, they are related to each other by parameters that we do know. Okay, so we could re-express the variance in terms of either one of the dephasing lengths. And then another quantity that we can measure is the magnetic correlation field. And that also gives you information about these dephasing lengths, because the correlation field is basically the change in the magnetic field that's needed to add a flux quantum to a phase coherent unit.
I have a question concerning how to view the freezing off the bulk states. If you look at your GZZ at relatively high temperatures, it's decaying the temperature, presumably exponentially. And what is the activation energy gap? Is that EAG lambda?
Okay, well, so I plotted the data up in an Arrhenius form, and you could see that at high temperatures, the decay looked like it was sort of on a straight line, but you could also plot it up in variable range hopping form, and it looks basically equally good.
Yeah, but is the value good? Far when you
can see it? It's very small. Okay, so if you extract an activation energy, you get something like a tenth of a millielectron volt, and we're working at about 10 Tesla. So the activation energy is very tiny, and that's something that that we don't understand.
Okay.